You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
Let's go.
It is Monday, June 16th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's show, folks, Matt Duss of the Center for American Progress. We're going to be talking about the ongoing unraveling and descent of Iraq into civil war. I'm going to be calling a lot of people to account. People who not only got Iraq wrong years ago, but would like to get it wrong all over again today. Plus, a Muslim woman harassed at the Texas Republican Convention. And what else we got there, Matty boy?
Well, I'll be bringing us the story of how conservatives are lowering the number of school shootings that have happened in this country. Wow, that's...
They're cutting school shootings?
Yeah, but...
Dude, you know what? We're going to need to step back and show them some proper respect if they're doing that.
I think we're going to, unless there's something really weird and bizarre that's what... In actuality, what they're doing. So we'll have to take a bigger look at that.
Uh-huh.
Also... as you all know, we freed that Marine down in Mexico because a bunch of bikers have went down there to break him out of Mexican jail. Oh, wait, no, I don't think that happened, but we'll bring you the hilarious story of the bikers.
I need you to get on your Harleys. I need you to go to the border.
That's Obama calling the bikers into action.
Yeah, that is. And boy, did they... I don't even know if they went into
that
action. We'll have to find out. We have tons more stories.
Really,
but we have
quick
a few
up top.
Things up top.
I know everybody's probably watching and enjoying the World Cup, and as we say, obviously, it's a great event. But we all know that FIFA is an absolutely despicable organization, and the whole situation in Brazil is incredibly toxic. And apparently, some police officers have been using live rounds, live
wow.
ammo on protesters in Brazil. Protesting all of the construction and neoliberal policies around the World Cup. We wanted to acknowledge that. Also.
Oh, also, there's a horrific story about a 45-year-old elephant, Satao, S-A-T-A-O. He's a 45-year-old, some people think he's a 50-year-old elephant, the largest or one of the largest elephants in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely famous, this elephant, in, and he was killed this past weekend by poachers, and what they, you know, it's just disgusting. It really is. These
yeah.
are an endangered animal, and they're a beautiful animal. They're an extremely intelligent animal.
And emotional. They're
yes.
very emotional.
In fact, when it comes to living things that are self-aware, there's humans, dolphins, and elephants. And that's pretty much, you know, that's a big, you know, it's, it, they know what's going on, and they know what's happening to them, and it's
yeah.
just sad. And if there's photos out there of what they did to this poor creature, and it's very upsetting, and
it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It really is.
Everybody, I just really quickly, we're gonna get to Matt Duss in a split second. There's some sort of drilling going on in this building. It's pretty low, but I think it shouldn't come through. But if it does for any reason, I want to apologize. We had absolutely no idea that this was happening. And if you hear something, that's what it is. We'll be right back with Matt Duss. We're talking Iraq.
Freedom of jail clips inserted. A baby's being born, same time a man is murdered. The beginning and end. As far as rap goes, it's only natural. I explain my plateau and also what defines my name. First it was nasty, but
but times have changed. Ask me now, I'm the artist, but hardcore, my signs for pain. I spent time in the game, kept my mind on fame. Saw things shoot up and do lines of saw my close friend shot, flatline of my same. That depends, carry MAC-10s to practice my aim. On rooftops, tape CD covers the trees. Line a barrel up with your weak pitcher and squeeze. Street scriptures for lost souls in the crossroads. To the corner thugs hustling for cars that cost dough. To the big dogs living large, taking it light. Pushing big toys, getting nice, enjoying your life is what you make it. Suicide, few tried to take it. Belt tied around their neck and jail cells naked. Heaven and hell, rap legend, presence is felt. And of course, NAS are the letters that spell.
Now it's like life or death. My rap, my poetry's deep, I never felt. Now it's like, now it's like, half man, half amazing. No doubt. Now it's like life or death. My rap, my poetry's deep, I never felt. Now it's like, now it's like, half man, half amazing. No doubt. Now it's like,
earth, wind, and fire, rims and tires, bulletproof glass inside is the realest driver. Planets in orbit, line them up with the stars. Tarot cards, you can see the Pharaoh Nas. Iron Mike, Messiah type, before the Christ, after the death, the last one left. Let my cash invest in stock, came a long way from blasting, text on blocks.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Matt Duss. He's a senior policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. Matt, how are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Very good to have you on. Let's obviously, everything in Iraq is very fast moving. There's a lot to keep track of, many pieces in play. But let's work it backwards a little bit. President Obama had a statement on Friday where he kind of outlined the situation pretty well and gave some certain possible inclinations of what he might do. But really, with the exception of clearly ruling out ground troops, it wasn't necessarily clear, at least for me, what the plan was. This morning, Secretary of State Kerry suggested, two interesting things. I mean, one, and I think it's a formalizing of the obvious, which is that we will at least be informally coordinating with Iran somewhat in Iraq because we both have concerns about the same group. And then he also held out the possibility of using drone strikes as part of a military response to the situation. So maybe if you could tease out what Kerry said and we could start to kind of work it backwards from there and get a sense of what's going on and what maybe the best policy paths are.
Sure. I mean, well, what Kerry said was just very basically that the United States is open to the, you know, just talking with Iran over what's happening in Iraq. Iran as a neighbor and as someone, you know, a country that enjoys significant influence in Iraq and has done so since the moment the United States toppled that government. Has its own interest. First of all, I mean, I think Iran's key interest in Iraq has always been just that Iraq not pose a threat to the security of Iran. It's very easy to understand why Iran and Iraq fought a hugely destructive eight-year war in the 1980s. A great deal of Iran's security policy was directed at preventing that threat from reemerging. And then, of course, you have the government that was installed by the United States is a Shia majority government, and its key leaders are longtime partners and clients and friends of Iran, and in many cases, as with Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister, but with many other members of the government, actually had refuge in Iran during the Saddam era.
Yeah.
So it kind of stands to reason that I think we can overstate the extent to which the United States and Iran have common interest in Iraq. It's certainly possible to do that, but at the very basic level, I think Iran and the United States both have an interest in Iraq that is not in complete collapse and is not a safe haven for terrorists such as ISIS or Al Qaeda. Who could pose a threat to Iran?
Absolutely. So let's get a little bit more into the specifics of who. I think people have some sense of what ISIS is. What though is the success they've been having? How broad a reflection? If we're going to disaggregate some things, so there's their drive, their success as an organization, in terms of how they're kind of getting funding, how they're funding themselves, how they're able to kind of acquire the territory they've been acquiring. How much does that owe to them as a very effective organization, which obviously they do seem to have a degree, a certain real degree of effectiveness, obviously. How much of that reflects them? And then how much is this a kind of just broader reflection of Sunni discontent and anger at the Maliki government and basically being repressed in the new Iraq?
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's certainly both. I mean, it's hard to say exactly how much of one versus how much of the other, but I mean, let's just, you know, recognize that, you know, you had a situation that was created by the United States when we went in, toppled the government, empowered the Shia majority, which has ruled in Iraq in a way that, you know, that it's not very inclusive, has been, you've had the Sunnis in Iraq after having oppressed the Shia and Kurdish, you know, majorities over the past decades, was now, you know, facing some payback. And then we had the situation of a sectarian civil war, insurgency, whatever word you want to use, where you had a lot of these foreign fighters coming in from surrounding countries and essentially going to insurgent boot camp in Iraq, with, you know, which the United States had created by going in there in the first place. So you'd have this phenomenon of foreign fighters, and these guys have formed essentially the core of ISIS, and they've gotten even more training and more experience, and gathered more followers and more recruits over the last several years in Syria, and have turned themselves into a fairly effective insurgent force, and they've been able to kind of take that and parlay that and exploit the continuing disaffection and sense of grievance that many Sunnis in Iraq feel toward the government.
So where does that go from in terms of that Sunni dynamic? Does that end there in a certain sense? And it, so if we took a place that's been overrun by ISIS, does the support that they received from Sunnis in the local population, that's a byproduct of what we just discussed in terms of the treatment of the Shia-led government and the dissatisfaction with the payback that they're on the receiving end of, does that mean that within the next couple of weeks or months there's a dissatisfaction with what ISIS is attempting to do in terms of implementing an incredibly sort of draconian form of Islamic governance? Did the splits then reemerge? So, okay, we're Sunnis together to protect ourselves from Shia, but now we're Sunnis and maybe we're moderate Sunnis, or maybe we're residual right. Baathists. Maybe, you know, did those kind of internal divisions start to emerge as well?
No, I think that's a great question, and I think the answer is most likely yes. I mean, this is the dynamic that we saw, you know, during the Iraq Civil War, is that you had these foreign fighters, these very extreme elements of al-Qaeda-oriented sort of global jihad fighters led by Zarqawi, who came in and allied with former Baathists and formed the insurgency, but then, you know, the al-Qaeda types just were so extreme that they managed to alienate their erstwhile allies. So I think we have a situation here where you have these Sunnis who are kind of willing to, if not actively, then at least passively, accept, you know, this ISIS force. But I think, you know, these guys are coming in and, you know, forcing women to, you know, wear, you know, complete, total body covering, no smoking, no alcohol, just, you know, no fun whatsoever. So I think, you know, you're going to, I would predict that you're going to see some of these tensions reemerging. You would have hoped or you would have thought that these guys would learn how to, not to alienate the local population as much. But you know, just from what I've seen over the past few days with how they're immediately establishing the most extreme interpretation of Islamic law in these places they take over, I think we're going to see some real tension emerge.
Well, I mean, right. It's kind of core to their brand. It's like asking Coke to open right. a new market without soft drinks. I mean, not to be glib about it, but that's what they do. So I think that the one kind of final piece of sort of table setting or history or context here that, and obviously this is not a yes or no answer, but it does seem to play, you know, there is a debate going on of relitigating previous Iraq policy that is relevant to the extent that it has bearing on what we do today and tomorrow and into the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seemed like with the surge, which was advocated obviously on the right, With the Sunni Awakening, which I think has broader kind of political buy-in. It seemed like a lot of people sort of got the basic concept of essentially recognizing that we need to build coalitions with local leadership and local tribes and kind of get buy-in. That seems pretty obvious. And then we left. Basically, Obama implemented what an agreement which was already basically actually established under the very end of the Bush administration, as you know, and you know, and then we left, and we left this pretty repressive Shia government in place with a close relationship with Iran, and that was certainly pretty ironic and not helpful for for a lot of Iraqis, and not particularly helpful for the region. But it seemed like we kind of left a patchwork together, and it was, you know, low grade, consistently bad. And now it's sort of exploded. Yeah. So what, I mean, to the extent that those previous policies and the withdrawal play a role, or is it a byproduct of Syria? I mean, what, you know, I think having a sense of where we put the attention on what has really precipitated the escalation of this crisis might give us some sense of what the smart thing to do now is.
Well, I think it's right to go back and look at the surge. Okay, I mean the argument behind the surge was twofold. First, you would send, you know, you would amp up the number of U.S. troops there. They would increase security. They eventually would work with some of these tribal leaders who would no longer fight for the insurgency, but would instead fight against the insurgency and help contribute to the, you know, increased security. But the second part of that was, once you have increased security, the theory was that you would create political space for to start a reconciliation between Iraq's various political communities. You would consolidate the government. You would get some real buy-in from all these various constituencies, and that just never happened. And I think what we've seen is that it's very difficult for any country, even one as powerful as the United States, to force governments to act inclusively if they really just don't want to. So I think we still have that problem. I mean, we can talk and discuss and debate about the extent to which Iraq falling apart really does impact U.S. security interests, but we're still faced with this partner government led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki that has shown no inclination to govern in, you know, to do any real power sharing, to take steps that would increase inclusiveness, that would address some of the very real and legitimate grievances of the Sunni minority in Iraq. So we're still kind of stuck.
Yeah, I think actually that is another important question to kind of, you know, get out there. What if we stripped away the hyperbole, but we also stripped away maybe some of the kind of, you know, cavalier minimization of the issue? I mean, what are the security stakes for the United States or Europe? Is there a sort of objective assessment of that?
Well, I think the is, and I think there's something to this. I mean, anytime you don't want big terrorist organizations to have, you know, to control pieces of territory they use for training, planning, etc. I think that's just a bad thing.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, it's always a question of, okay, where do they actually have bases, and what is the extent to which that actually is a danger? What is this group about? Do they have aspirations to attack the United States? But I think we do have an interest, you know, in stability in the region. We have an interest in lots of people not being killed. That is happening right now.
Right.
We have an interest in people believing that the United States will kind of follow through on our commitments. Speaking here from a sort of moral standpoint, I do think the United States does have something of a debt to Iraq here. I think we can, you know, I think good progressives can disagree about, you know, what our tools are, what the, you know, how we can go about sort of satisfying this. But, you know, we went in there, we removed the government, we essentially ran an occupation that saw the state almost completely collapse. And they're still dealing with, you know, with the fallout from that. Now, a lot of these problems are ones that they have made for themselves. As I said, Nouri al-Maliki and his government has not governed in a very responsible, legitimate, or inclusive way. So it's not that this is all on the U.S., but I think there's no question that we do have, you know, we have incurred a responsibility to kind of get hands on deck here and try to handle this. That's not to say we should reinvade or do airstrikes or what have you. It's not to say that we necessarily shouldn't do any of those things, although I think I'm against sending troops there. I'm open to the idea that some limited strikes could make a difference, although I'm very, very skeptical. But still, at the end of the day, we have this central problem of this is a government that's not shown any willingness to govern responsibly.
Yeah, let's get more to that in a second, because that does, those are sort of the core questions from a U.S. policy point of view. I think the last thing I want to introduce in the conversation is it does seem like the Kurds have, if anybody has benefited from this situation pretty consistently, it has been the Kurdish community in Iraq, and Kurdish governance seems relatively effective, certainly compared to the rest of the country. So I guess both on a level of what is their role in blocking the encroachment of ISIS and these forces, and I guess more broadly, is this, with all of these factors in play and the place kind of coming apart and Kurdistan being a place that sort of works, is this a time when they actually just sort of formally break off, or do they even want to do that? Because frankly, things seem to be working fairly well for them. So why kind of unnecessarily agitate a situation by formalizing something that is kind of operating informally anyways?
Right. No, I think that's pretty much the thinking as I gather it, is that they are essentially independent. They have, they have their own territory. They run their own foreign policy. They have their own embassy, for example, here in the United States. The function, it functions as, the Kurdish embassy. But, why exacerbate the situation needlessly by going that extra step? That's not to say they won't in the future. I think at some point they probably will. But let's also remember that the Kurds had a bit of a head start. They had, a relatively safe zone in northern Iraq for a few years, before the U.S. invasion. You really have to recognize that they have, even though they have their own internal differences, they have been able to sort of pull together and create, an effectively independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq.
So moving towards what should or shouldn't be done, it seems like, and President Obama, he whatever you think of his various, policy successes or failings a kind of full assessment of his record, he knows how to kind of analytically lay things out. And it seemed like he basically said the prime takeaway, I think, on Friday was, look, I'm not going to rule anything out, but And I do mean look, because that's obviously how President Obama likes to start a lot of his sentences. So I got look, but there is the possibility of action, and then there's the reality that you've continued to go back to that, prop Maliki and all of these problems are going to stay in place. And it seems like everything has just kind of turned into, to an extent, and I think it's a valuable thing and worthwhile thing to do. I'll do some more of it later on the show. But the left is kind of reminding everybody of who created and generated this mess and this catastrophe to begin with. And now the right is kind of all reemerged to sort of do the whole, chest beating, and Obama's going to look like he wants to ride a pony and we're not going to be safe and blah, 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 blah. But where in this is the actual solution to this, which is, as you say, you can't force conclusive governance, and that seems to be the clearest solution. Is that just the one thing that might actually do this here, is what's unavailable? And then in that context, what would cause the least minimum harm, basically?
Right. Well, no, first on, the people who got us in there, I think it's fine and important to remember who said what, especially with some of the most, brazen and sort of macho, aggressive proponents of the Iraq War, like, John McCain, Bill Kristol, all these guys who made these very wild claims that just didn't pan out. But I think what's even more important is remembering those claims and those theories about the way the world works, about the way that American power works, and about the capacity of American military power to create certain outcomes. I think what's most important is to remember why those theories turned out not to be true. So fine. If people say, let's not play the blame game. Oh, I think we can play the blame game and talk about what we should do at the same time. You know, we're smart, intelligent people. We can do all of these things. But getting to what Obama should do, again, there are a number of questions that I still have, that I think have yet to be really answered. What tools does the U.S. have at its disposal? We have a lot of tools, military, diplomatic, economic, and otherwise. What can each of these tools do to actually change the situation on the ground? At what cost? And then what are steps, B, C, D, and E? He's very smart to kind of try and think through that.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, does that just sort of mean that we are actually quite literally, I mean, at least from a military perspective of a military option, we should really, I mean, at the very least be waiting and really assessing, not kind of just jumping in because, oh, there's this horrible situation and we need to go in and do something now. We need to think somewhat more contextually, and that means doing things like having some talks with Iran, talking with other regional stakeholders. I mean, as a kind of final point, as we get towards wrapping up, I'd also, what's the role of our relationship with Saudi Arabia, as an example, and even
right.
at least
no, it's the, really good.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, it's really important to get to that, and I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to bring it up as well. I mean, it is good to understand that what is happening, as with Syria and now in Iraq, and this is true even, of what was happening in Iraq during the U.S. occupation, is that it is a proxy war, a part of a proxy Cold War, whatever term you want to use, between Iran and states like Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Gulf states. So that we see that playing out, but it's also a sort of it highlights tensions within the Sunni camp as well, between very very hardcore extremists like ISIS, like Al Qaeda. Between less extreme Sunni Muslims, but then you have there was a report the other day that even if it's not the governments of countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others supporting these extremists, that you do have private individuals, very wealthy individuals in these countries, who have been sending money and supporting these extreme insurgent groups.
It would almost be like, just to give an analogy, if the Koch brothers or somebody like that, that they're just the first ones that come to mind, I'm not trying to sort of besmirch them, but if they had a direct – maybe I am – if they had a direct business relationship with the Zeta drug cartel in Mexico and they directly sent them a significant amount of money, that is not U.S. foreign policy – but it's still a significant amount of resources coming from powerful, well-connected people in the United States. And that's the type of thing coming out of the Gulf, even if it isn't necessarily from governments.
Right. And so it's on, the responsibility, I think, is on those governments to try and control that.
Yeah.
So the question is, to what extent are they sort of getting a wink from these governments?
Well, absolutely. So there's just, I guess it's just many questions to answer and many things to figure out as this crisis kind of rolls on. But I appreciate your time very much, Matt Duss, and I appreciate helping us get sort of bigger context and framework for sort of understanding or doing our best to have some sense of what's going on there.
All right. Happy to. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, folks. That is some of the picture of what's going on in Iraq and really the whole region, because that's exactly right. It's Iran and the Gulf states, and there's a proxy war going on, and that's really what is fundamentally driving this. We're going to go to the better half. I'm going to follow up on some of these things with some more Iraq stories. We're going to take a little trip down memory lane. Sam did a little bit of that last week. I'm going to go a little bit deeper. Because people are just saying wonderful and amazing things every day. It's like you've woken up and you're in a nightmare. And it's 2002 and 2003 and all these horrible people that you had thought at least they went away. Well, they're all back. And they may not well, I'll get to more of it. There's a lot of really rich things here. Also, a Muslim woman harassed at the Texas Republican State Convention. We just got a buffet for you. It's the fun half. We got everything.
Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, breaking news. Conservatives have managed to lower the amount of school shootings going on in this country.
What?
They've done it. Here we are complaining about gun control and how we need to close loopholes and make sure that background checks are occurring at places where they're not. And, you know, guns shouldn't be able to be freely bought and purchased at the day you walk into the store and to take home and use. And how, you know, maybe you don't need a gun that has a magazine that allows you to shoot a 500 times before you need to reload. But we're just wasting time on that because conservatives have the answer.
I'm in all ears.
As you all know, there's been a statistic going around where a group called Everytown, what are they exactly? It is, Everytown is the group that, it's a former Mayor Michael Bloomberg umbrella group that advocates for gun control. Everytown for gun safety. And there's been a statistic that there's been 74 school shootings since the Newtown shooting. That was the end of 2012. So from the end of 2012 to today, there has been 74 school shootings. However, outlets like CNN are now reporting that there has instead just been 15 school shootings. I mean, that's still a lot, but how did they get the – how did conservatives do this? Oh, by complaining so much about the term school shooting to groups like CNN to the point where school shooting is now redefined. So, oh, man, what – wow. So these 15 are actually the ones that were in that seven. So they actually didn't do shit. Those people are still dead. There's still that amount of school shootings going on.
Well, wait, but what are the specific ways that they're disputing a school shooting? I want
to
know this.
Let's get down to this. Because this all came from one man, Charles C. Johnson, a self-described journalist who called several of the shootings listed in every town's list of 74 as fake. Newsbusters, Hot Air, Gun Rights Radio, Independent Journal Review, which is like the conservative upworthy, all joined in.
A great name.
To basically force news outlets like CNN, who...
Let's start a viral video.
Good job, CNN, standing firm on this one. They've convinced them to revise this number from 74 to 15. And why is that? What happened to these 59 shootings that just are no longer school shootings? I guess these people just rose from the dead and are no longer gone.
Jesus, finally, they brought out their A player.
So let's take a look at Charles C. Johnson's Twitter feed. Oh, by the way, he calls himself a debunker of Everytown, and he's trying to raise money off of this. So let's see what some of these tweets are pointing out these fake shootings. Charles C. Johnson tweets. Another fake school shooting listed by Everytown. He had a whole list of them on his Twitter feed. And what is this fake school shooting? Honor student shoots self in front of class. That's not a real school shooting!
Yeah, excuse me.
Excuse me. I'm picturing this guy. Like, I'm picturing literally, like, the poor honor student commits this act and kills himself in front of his classmates. His body's on the floor, and fucking Charles C. Johnson ducks in, jumps in, points to the floor, and goes, "Not a real school shooting! Fake! Fake! This is a fake!" Like, him just jumping in at all these occasions. Just pointing
or maybe more like, "Hey, look, I'm sorry not to be tasteless here, but I just need to be clear here. This doesn't count.
This doesn't count.
All right, back to grieving exactly, students. Yes. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Another fake school shooting listed by Everytown. A gunman ran onto a campus, was chased by police, and shot a student accidentally. Whoops! Not a school shooting! I mean, are you kidding me?
Guy was robbing a Denny's and running away. What's that got to do with the school? What's the matter with you?
Listen, you lost your child at the school, but not a school shooting. I'm sorry. Let's get to one more here. There's just so many.
We got to fit some specs here.
Another fake school shooting listed by Everytown. Northwest High School principal shot by her ex-husband on campus. Just amazing.
That is obviously not
a school shooting. Listen.
That's a lover's spat.
There was no student involved here, just teachers. We all know that they don't count.
Right.
I mean, listen, if the Newtown shooting just took out the principal and a few of the teachers, he would have got away with not a school shooting. I would like to see CNN start reporting those, too. There's been a not school shooting at Roosevelt High School. And, I mean, really? Like, are you kidding me?
Hey, would you like to get a hall pass from Mrs. Patterson? Well, not anymore. You can't. See, kids, not a school shooting.
Not a school
shooting. Your principal just got murdered by her ex-husband.
Hey, not school shooting is just broken out across the country. And amazing.
How demented are these people?
Like, and this guy's raising money off of this. Like, yeah. He's literally, like, this is his project. Like, this is his new project. Yeah. Debunking the school shooting numbers. Are you kidding me?
How demented.
Something like 25 people died in those not school shootings, and something like close to 100 people were injured in those not school shootings. I guess they're not dead and not injured
anymore.
Is he
also including things like, well, I mean, that was a gang.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to the specifics of what is not a school shooting are anything that involves a personal argument, accident, or alleged gang activity or drug deal. I mean, that's pretty much everything.
I mean,
literally the only thing it doesn't cover is if, like, someone who's just, like, a mentally ill person decides to do something. But it can't be an accident. If you're mentally ill and just want to shoot somewhere and you just happen across a school as you're being chased by police, that's not a school. Like, if those Vegas shooters went to the CC's first, killed those two cops, and then were chased to a school instead of a Walmart, and then they started shooting people, that would not be a school shooting.
No, of course not.
That would not be a school shooting.
No, this guy is saying we need to get more rigorous about this stuff. I actually want this to start applying to every part of life. I want it to like, well, I would be stealing this set of designer sunglasses if I had thought about doing it at 10 a.m., and then I had planned it at noon.
Yeah, it was an accident.
Yeah, but if I just did that now, then obviously that doesn't count.
I love how the personal dispute is taken out of it. I love how that's not a school shooting.
What do personal disputes have to do with school shootings?
Do we take out any school shooting? Like, is Columbine a school shooting now, though? Because it said that those kids were bullied or whatever, so they took it out on the people who they viewed as jocks and the popular kids. So that could be technically a personal dispute, right?
We just had personal disputes with a lot of people.
Yes.
Not school shooting.
Yeah.
Not school shooting.
I mean, literally the only school shooting that I could think of that doesn't fit in here is Newtown. Like, Newtown is the only school shooting.
But could you imagine that your definition
but wait
of
a minute.
Success?
The personal dispute, though, was with his mom. Does that, even though she wasn't at the school, does that count? He went in there with a personal dispute and was taking it out his rage on these kids at the school he used to go to. There has never been a school shooting! Dude, we've solved the gun issue!
Consider your minds blown.
We can't bring your children back, but you know, rest easy at night knowing they died in a not school shooting.
Can you imagine that your metric of success? I mean, we just got it down to zero, but this guy isn't even real. He's not as good as this as we are, so he's only got it down to 15. And your metric of success is no. You guys are full of shit. It's only 15 school shootings. It's not that big of a deal. Could you imagine?
Like 15 is enough too.
Do you want to be in that position in a debate where she's like, whoa, calm down, everybody.
I feel like it's only been
15
you know what?
Legitimate slaughters in schools with serious weapons.
I wonder if, like, they were at 74. So I wonder if, like, somewhere some conservative once said, like, some gun rights conservative once said, listen, when we get to 75 school shootings, then we'll start looking at the Second Amendment and what we could really do about gun violence in this country. Let me know when we get to 75. That'll never happen. And then they get to 74, and it's like, shit, we need to start redefining what makes a school shooting.
All right, this is a predominantly minority school. Doesn't count. Okay, personal dispute. All right, somebody was on Prozac at some point. Doesn't count. All right, it was a full moon, and there was a...
It's amazing.
It was a week before Halloween. It was 3 weeks before Christmas. It was right before the Thanksgiving holiday. So really, when you round it out, now, I mean,
Those were holiday shootings.
Those were holiday shootings. At this point, we're down to five.
Really? We don't really. I mean, and listen, was school in session? Really? Was it after school?
And what is this recess bullshit? What if a kid comes in and starts opening fire during recess? Are you really at school during recess? Because as far as I'm concerned, you're outside having fun. It's more like a fun outdoors shooting, as far as I'm concerned.
Really? I mean,
And if you go to an athletic field,
let's really get down to it, too. What is school? I mean, all right.
I mean, when you think about it, dude, we could literally be living inside the fingernail of a giant man. Yeah. And I guess what I'm trying to say is there's been no school shootings.
Listen, let me know when there's been a beanstalk. Then we'll, okay.
We got tons of stuff coming up in the better half. Going into the better half, we have the bikers who are traveling down to Mexico who are, they're going to save the day and break this Marine out of Mexican jail. And InfoWars are on the search for Bo Bergdahl. I don't know if they realize we found him and he's home now, but we'll get to that. That and more, actually, in the better or fun half, whichever you prefer.
Whichever you prefer.
Before we get to that, though, Sam wanted me to wanted us to mention this. On Tuesday, June 17th, that's tomorrow, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, will be
NARAL.
Hosting. NARAL. Oh, they actually pronounce it NARAL?
NARAL.
Okay. NARAL, Pro-Choice America, will be hosting a Men for Choice and the Women Who Love Them happy hour in New York City at Hudson Terrace. Sam, as a member of the event's host committee, would be thrilled if you joined. We will have a link up on the website where you can find out more information about how you can attend this event here in New York. It should be a good time.
Sounds good. Great place to meet women, guys. That was the obvious
Michael's
joke.
Michael's being funny.
That was the obvious joke. No, seriously, they do incredibly important work.
I mean, it's right there in the title, and the women who love
them. Well, I mean that, yeah. Right. It was a gimme. But seriously, they, as everybody knows, NARAL is actually, I would say, I mean, NARAL, I've known some people who've done some work around that, with them. They're hugely effective. And, you know, as we know on this show, that the war against women and the war against women's health is being waged state by state and on a local level. NARAL's on top of it. It's an awesome event. I can't go to it, but I wish I could. But go there, meet Sam, support a great cause, become a member today. MajorityReport.com/become a member.
Majority.fm/become a member.
I mean, become a member for all the reasons we tell you every day. Every day, you know, when people join, they tell us how happy they are. They feel great. Less than a cup of coffee. You know the deal. Follow us on Twitter.
You know, typing in themajorityreport.com will get you to our website, but just Majority Report will not.
I am aware of this. Follow us on Twitter at themajorityreport. I'm just playing. At Majority FM. Like us on Facebook, which actually is The Majority Report on Facebook.
YouTube.com/SamCedar. That's for the that's for where we put up all of our clips from shows and also
additional
stuff. Me and Mike, Matt and Michael. If you're not sure who was saying me, we put up we're trying to put up some more YouTube exclusive type stuff for you all to enjoy. Things that we just don't have time to fit onto the podcast. Michael's got his Everything You Need to Know in 3 minutes segment that we put up on YouTube. We'll have some more of those type of segments and clips going up shortly. To watch the full live show every day as it's happening on YouTube, that channel is youtube.com/majorityreportlive. And if you're a member, we post the links to every show that we record via YouTube for the live stream up on the day's members podcast post. So if you're a member, you not only have access to the full show, if you're a member, you also have access to the complete archive, as many as YouTube is archiving, which well, we started doing this back in January of last year. So you have over a year's worth of full shows on video that you can
basically
access anytime.
Being a member is an awesome thing. I'm firing up the IMs. You can join us.
We never really promoted it like that before, but we should definitely make it known. You could watch the full video versions of the show too via if you're a member.
You can do it all. Join us. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-3920.
We will 646-257-3920.
646-257-3920.
You forgot the one. Okay.
You forgot the one.
You did forget. All right, everyone. See you in the better half.
See you in the better half.